Good evening and welcome to Lesson 5. I'd like to dedicate tonight's class. It's a yahrzeit of Yisrael Aaron Ben Dover, Irving Tatz, husband of Beverly Tatz, mother, father of Janet Tatz, of Helena. There's a memorial plaque in the shul in their memory, in his memory. I happened to be part of his burial 7 years ago, and so I told his wife today that we would study in Irving's memory. We'll start with the introduction, the morning after grief and consolation. Dan, we'll start with you. Go right ahead.
Bereavement, it is pointless to attempt to describe this feeling. Those who've experienced it know and remember it all too well. For those fortunate enough to not have experienced it, no words will enable them to relate to the depth of the loss, pain, and agony. The Jewish perspective on mourning and its associated rituals provide the survivors with a healthy channel for the crushing grief and the necessary tools to, when the time is right, reemerge and cope with life after death.
And so we spent 4 weeks talking about the Jewish perspective on death and what happens when to the soul after you pass on. And it's all very nice. You know the story about the rabbi who always spoke about nurturing children and the warmth we need to have for children and children. Every sermon was about children and how kind we need to be to children. One day he shows up at the shul. They just repaved the driveway of the synagogue with new cement. And there's a bunch of kids running around, putting their footprints in the new concrete. So he loses his cool. He starts screaming at the kids. So one of the congregants went over to him and said, "I don't understand. You've been screaming for years. You've been preaching for years about how we have to nurture children and educate children and uplift children and be warm to children. And now you're screaming at them." To which he responded, he said, "You must understand, I love the children in the abstract, not in the concrete." And so, you know, it's very nice to talk about, oh yeah, death and the soul flies away here and comes there and there's a nefesh and there's a ruach and 30 days and 7 days. In reality is, when someone actually passes away in our life, when we're actually mourning the passing of someone that's dear to us, whatever level, we don't have to go right now into the details, whether it's family or friends or someone that meant a lot to us and a symbolic figure, but someone that means something to us on some level or another passes on, and suddenly, whoa, 4 JLI classes very quickly go right out the door, and now we're trying to figure out how, not only theoretically, but practically, how am I going to implement Judaism, how am I going to implement the Jewish perspective in my life? You know, the story about the guy standing at Niagara Falls, he's a tightrope walker, and he's screaming, "Who thinks I can cross right across Niagara Falls?" And the big crowd goes, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, we believe, we believe." So he says, "Who thinks I can cross pushing a wheelbarrow? And we believe, we believe." And on that note, he says, "I'm looking for a volunteer to go into the wheelbarrow." And suddenly no one was available anymore. Because we believe, but when it comes, and push comes to shove, when reality kicks in and we're the ones mourning, we have to figure out a mechanism, a program for how do we actually incorporate the proper perspective. What is the proper perspective from a Jewish perspective and Torah perspective, and how we deal with death, how we deal with the loss of a loved one? And obviously when it comes to loss, the first thing we need to understand is that every person grieves differently. A big mistake is that you always see mostly non-Jewish religious figures, but plenty of Jewish ones along the way as well, who they studied the topic. I never went to school where they taught me about how to deal with people with bereavement. And I'm actually happy I didn't, because then you come with all these one-liners, they tell you, "Oh, this is a great line you can tell people." I don't want someone to tell me a one-liner I can tell someone. That's so fake. It's so generic. You want to be able to talk to people from your heart, and it's one of the hardest things you have to do is talk to someone when they're mourning, because what are we supposed to say? What is our perspective? Christians have it easy. They tell them, now they're in a much better place. And that's it. You're happy because you think you said something nice. They're trying to buy into whatever you're selling, which isn't easy, but you feel like you did your job. What is our perspective when either we're experiencing loss or someone we know is experiencing loss? Let's look at the different ways people grieve. Let's get started with that. Text number one. Go ahead, Kathy.
Heather Lindquist was in the kitchen cleaning up after lunch when she heard a dull thud. It sounded as if it came from the hallway, and it was just a little too loud to ignore. "Boy," she yelled, "what are you up to?" There was no answer. She found her two boys playing quietly on the couch in the living room. They giggled. "You joker," she said with a smile. "What was that sound?" They shrugged. "Where is your father?" Without waiting for an answer, she ran toward the hallway. She cried out in fear when she found her husband John writhing on the floor. John had severe asthma. He was taking a new medication and it seemed to be working, but suddenly had collapsed in the worst attack he'd ever had. Heather tried everything she could think of to save her husband's life. Then she called an ambulance. The rest was a blur. John died of a cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital. Heather was 34 years old. Her boys were 5 and 7. That moment, John's death felt like the worst thing that could have happened to her, ever have happened to her. Heather Lindquist had lived her entire life in the same quiet suburban community in Northern New Jersey. She and John had been high school sweethearts. They married and purchased a small ranch-style house. They had children. They got a dog. The schools were good and the community was stable. Heather thought that the television was on more than it should be, but other than that, everything seemed in order. Then John died, and she had to rethink it all. Now she was a single parent. She had to find new ways to earn money and also find extra time to be with her boys. And somehow she had to contain everyone's anguish. She found strength she didn't know she had. It was lonely and painful at times. But Heather found meaning and vigor and even joy in the idea that she was going to make it. I expected to collapse. I really did. That's what I wanted to do. That would have been the easiest thing to do, Heather explained. But I couldn't. Each day I got up and did what I had to do. The days passed and somehow it was okay. The boys were great. They were upset in the beginning, of course, we all were. They hung in there and we stayed together. I love these boys so much, John would have been proud of them.
So this is just, you know, it sounds like a typical story. They moved forward, they didn't get stuck in the depression or the sadness or the mourning. And, you know, she really had no choice. She had two little kids, 5 and 7 years old. She had no choice but to wake up every day and give them the best life she can give them. So despite the mourning, despite the sadness, she had to go on. But then look at text number two. Go ahead, Linda. Look at the total opposite.
In 2004, Stephanie Moldberg of Short Hills, New Jersey, lost her son, Eric, 13, to Ewing's sarcoma, a bone cancer. 4 years after Eric's death, Ms. Moldberg, now 48, walked around like a zombie. "I felt guilty all the time. Guilty about living," she said. "I couldn't walk into the deli because Eric couldn't go in there any longer. I couldn't play golf because Eric couldn't play golf. My life was a mess. And I couldn't talk to my friends about it because after a while, they didn't want to hear about it. Stephanie, you need to get your life back," they'd say. "But how could I? On birthdays, I'd shut the door and take the phone off the hook. Eric couldn't have any more birthdays. Why should I?"
And so here you have the total opposite. You have someone who got stuck, and you're talking about 4 years later, and they can't do anything. They're paralyzed. They can't function. And I bet it's safe to say that some of us on some level or another have experienced people on both sides of the spectrum, maybe mostly in the middle, but people who really don't know how to overcome. People who overcome very well and they move forward, even though obviously they have a gate, you know, a hole in their heart, but they move forward. And the real question for tonight, the questions for discussion is, Heather and Stephanie reacted differently to their respective losses. Is one response healthier than the other? Is Heather in denial and is Stephanie overreacting? Why did the two women react differently? Do you know someone who did or did not deal well with loss? Why was that person equipped or ill-equipped to cope with his or her grief? Now, if you take these two particular cases, you can analyze it just off the bat. You say, listen, in the case of Heather, the one that lost her husband like that from asthma, she didn't see a lot of suffering going on. She didn't have to be there for years and years of watching and experiencing and the children certainly didn't have to watch their father suffer, unlike Stephanie, who watched her son die slowly from a horrible bone cancer. And that can have a very, very bad effect on you. The other difference is we don't know much about Stephanie, but we know that Heather had two reasons to keep going. That was her two children. We don't know what Heather had and whether she had that reason, that drive to keep her going. And so it's very safe to say that people grieve differently. And no, Heather wasn't in denial. I'm sure she had her moments of sadness. And Stephanie wasn't necessarily overreacting. It's not like she chose to do that. She had a very hard time struggling with and coping with the loss that she experienced. My mother had a dear friend who lost a son who didn't wake up one morning at the age of 21. It took, I'm not sure she's there yet either, but it took years and years before she could even have a normal conversation. Go ahead, Linda.
And it's different when you lose a child than when you lose a spouse. It's a different kind of love.
The Talmud says that burying your own child is the worst thing you could do in the world, but, you know, we should never know from that. But I trust your assessment of it. But it's definitely the loss, you know, any type of loss that a person's experiencing. So maybe the difference between Heather and Stephanie would be the fact that it was a child versus a spouse. That could very well be another one of the differences. But the reality is that everyone also responds emotionally differently. Even amongst my own siblings, when we lost my mother, it was a different animal. Everyone with their own program. This one cried a lot. This one went to a therapist. This one wrote weekly emails and invited 900 people to listen to him cope. And so he got away with it by using group therapy. I won't mention who that was. And they all laughed at him and said, oh, you don't have to go to a therapist. You just send out an email. And you know, everyone's listening. So everyone deals differently. And there is no real official way about a person responds. However, we do need to utilize the Torah's perspective. Because the Torah does give us perspective. The Torah doesn't tell us how we can feel. The Torah can't tell you how to feel. The Torah can tell you what to do with those feelings. Now, the Torah is going to respect the fact that you feel one thing or another. And the question is, what are you going to do with the feelings that you have? Some of it will go back to things we discussed in the previous classes. Some of it will be tonight totally new as it turns from theory into practicality. If we step back for a moment, we have to ask ourselves a question: is mourning in general appropriate or ideal? Or is it an expression of weakness and an indication of lack of faith? What would you think? Is it weak to mourn? Or is it ideal to mourn?
I think it's necessary to mourn. I think it is necessary to recognize loss, to go through the process of it, to pass through the pain, and to keep your eye on the light at the end of the tunnel. Mourning is necessary.
How many of you have studied Socrates along the way somewhere, a little bit about him? So we know that Socrates disagreed with you wholeheartedly. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that Socrates,
he liked to argue, that's okay.
He definitely liked to argue. He challenged all the received wisdom, which made him very unpopular. And he was very he was eventually put on trial and found guilty of corrupting the minds of the youth of Athens and impiety. And to quote them, it was not believing in the gods of the state. And while he was, he was sentenced to death. Eventually, they poisoned him. But shortly before he was put to death, I think they gave him some kind of cocktail or something. But before he... Huh? Before they put him... I went to yeshiva. Before they put him to death, he was visited in prison by several of his disciples. And in the course of the conversation, Socrates asked his disciple, Cebes, I think they pronounced his name, Cebes? He asked his disciple to convey the following message to the other disciple. One of them particularly was a poet, so he asked him to pass it on. This was the message he was sending from the prison prior to his death. Go ahead, Frank, text number 3.
Tell this to Evenus, Cebes, Socrates said, and bid him be of good cheer. Say that I would have him come after me, if he be a wise man, and not tarry. And that today I am likely to be going, for the Athenians say that I must. Simmias said, what a message for such a man. Having been a frequent companion of his, I should say that, as far as I know him, he will never take your advice unless he is obliged. Why, said Socrates, is not Evenus a philosopher? I think that he is, said Simmias. Then he, or any man who has the spirit of philosophy, will be willing to die, but he will not take his own life, for that is held to be unlawful. The day may come when you will understand why, though a man is better dead, he is not permitted to be his own benefactor, but must wait for the hand of another.
So here, no one can ever claim that Socrates wasn't a wise man. He was. Even from a Jewish perspective, people like Maimonides and others recognize Socrates as a very, very intelligent individual, and yet his philosophy was very clear that death is something to be yearned for. Don't commit suicide, don't end your own life, but But when that comes, be grateful that death comes, because death frees you from the limitations of the body, of the flesh, and what's greater than the mind experiencing whatever it can experience outside of the limitations of the body. That was his philosophy, so much so that there's an opinion that says that he had the possibility to escape the prison, and he refused to do it because he said that would be the antithesis of his entire philosophy. Because if I escape from the potential of death, that means I'm scared of death. Why would I be scared of death? Death is something to be welcomed or cherished. And the question is, we know that Judaism disagrees with that. The question is why? Why does Judaism disagree with that? Judaism is the one that tells us that this world that we live in is Alma de Shikre, world of falsehood. And that the world to come is the Olam Emes, the world of truth. If this is falsehood and that is truth, why shouldn't we agree with Socrates and get the hell out of here as soon as we can? Go ahead, Kathy.
Okay, but the question that you posed, whether mourning is necessary, I want to point out that when we read about Heather, and we read about Stephanie, we read about John, and we read about Eric, and that we didn't read anything about what happened to them, or even that the women were even concerned about what happened to them. We heard about how they were dealing with their own loss.
But that's what the point of today's class is.
So for
four classes, we spoke about what happens to the soul. Today the question is how we deal with that.
Yeah, but so this that we're reading right here, the fact that someone might go on to a greater freedom or whatever, still doesn't mean that the people they leave behind are not going to experience loss in their life.
Okay, very good, very good. If we were playing hot and cold, you'd be warm. There's definitely that side of it, and that's where we're heading. But to point out that the love, not the love, but the acceptance of death, if we truly incorporated Socrates' ideas, then we would have a much greater tolerance and acceptance of death, and we clearly don't. Judaism does not expect us to have tolerance for death. Let's look at some... Go ahead, Linda, before we continue.
Just a quick thing that I remember from maybe it was last week. You're saying that the soul doesn't really want to leave heaven. And come to earth
reluctantly,
right? But it's here on earth that we have the opportunity for action,
right?
To do the mitzvot,
to transform the world,
and to make it a place that God would want to come down and live in,
right?
So, what does that have to do with?
And to regenerate the 613 parts of the soul.
So,
yeah, the spark.
Let's see if there's anything to do with how we accept death versus mourning according to the Jewish perspective. Let's look at text 4a. Go ahead, Connie. We're up to you.
The Torah does not disallow mourners to cry because it is human nature to be moved to tears when taking leave of loved ones, even if they are still alive and merely traveling to a distant location.
Right, so let's start from the basics. Judaism does not, there are other religions, for example, Islam, who don't allow you to mourn. You ever see what goes on at a Muslim funeral? They're screaming Allahu Akbar, and they're screaming statements. No one's crying. You ever see people cry at a Muslim funeral?
No.
Go on YouTube, Google a Muslim funeral. I don't recommend it actually. But I'm saying it's a reality. Their religion does not look at death. Death is an exciting thing.
Really?
Well, are all those virgins waiting?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something, by the way, it's not something that some radicals made up. I just want to clarify this idea of martyrs and getting 72 virgins and all that. That's based in the Hadith and the Quran, whichever book you want to pick from their religion. And I'm not here to discuss the negativity of what radical Islam is up to. My point is just that there is traditions that people have where you don't mourn. Judaism makes it very clear that we do mourn. And crying is not a bad thing. Even if your relative was leaving to Australia for 7 years, I remember going to Israel once for summer. I mean, I guess I went for the summer when I was 11 years old. My mother was standing at the El Al terminal in JFK, crying like it was a funeral. I said, "Mom, I'm coming back in 6 weeks. What's the big deal?" I was flying as an unaccompanied minor. I was excited. I got all this freedom. I'm going to Israel. And I never forget, my father was standing there like a father. And my mother was standing like it's a funeral. Wow. So certainly when someone's leaving for longer than 7 weeks, someone's leaving permanently and they're leaving a realm that you can actually interact with on a physical level, of course it's okay to mourn. But let's go even further. 4b, go ahead, Jennifer.
Mourners find comfort in crying and wallowing in their sorrow to the point that the body is weakened by the intense emotions. In the same manner as happy persons find contentment in various forms of amusements.
In other words, what did Maimonides just add? What did what Jennifer read just add to what Connie read? What did Maimonides add to the previous statement from Nachmanides? If you look back, what Connie read from Nachmanides basically said that crying is natural. What Maimonides is adding over here is that not only is it natural, but there's actually some psychological benefits to crying. It actually helps you. If I may say so myself, I know it's not manly, but because men never cry. But when you cry, you feel like you've lifted a rock or a stone off your heart. That's not something just, you know, that you're, you know, you sometimes think you're a little crazy and it's not real. It's real. There's a psychological effect to crying, to letting that out, that affects you. And so that's a benefit. Judaism sees that as a benefit. When someone doesn't express their emotions and it's bottled up, that is not a healthy thing. I know a lot of men think it is, but it's not. But it goes even further. Look at text 4c. Go ahead, Stana.
One of the great men of the generation lost a son and did not shed a single tear. It is praiseworthy.
Is this
a praiseworthy reaction? Answer. Such behavior is offensive and objectionable. It demonstrates heartlessness, distasteful character, and cruelty. This is the way of the philosophers who maintained that this world is worthless. And as such, death is not a major concern and not worth bewailing. We who have received the Torah believe that this world is of great value for those who properly utilize their time here and behave appropriately. It is only through our actions in this world that we merit the world to come. Crying, mourning, and shedding tears after the passing of a relative, and especially for an honorable person, is the way of the pious, the prophets, and the people of good deeds. It is not for naught that our sagas, that our sages tell us, 3 days for weeping, 7 for eulogies, and 30 for observing the restrictions on wearing new clothing and getting haircuts. If weeping were improper, the sages would not have instituted a 3-day period for this. We see that our father Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and weep for her. And we also find that Jacob, King David, and innumerable others mourned the passing of loved ones.
So here the Radvaz of David ben Zibra, 16th century, he directly takes on Socrates' philosophy. It says they have no reason to mourn because they don't look at death as a negative thing. On the contrary, they look at it as a good thing. And if someone looks at death as a good thing, then why in the world would you mourn for something good? Be happy. Which is why we go back to the most common example, which is the way they deal with martyrs, for example, in Islam. Why would you be sad? If the guy's getting 72 virgins, you'd think that would be an exciting thing. And so, you know, why be sad? Be happy. But the Rabbah says here very clearly that it's a very Jewish thing theologically. Because, like you mentioned, Linda, because we believe there's so much to accomplish in this world, no matter how real the afterlife is, and no matter how true it is that the soul continues to live on, which we discussed already in all the previous lessons, the reality is that they won't be able to do what they can do here anymore, and we won't be able to interact with them on that level, and for that there is something to mourn. Not permanent mourning forever, but there is a program for mourning, and if you don't mourn, we have to start questioning what are your motives and why are you so off the path of Judaism in the perspective of how we deal with that. Which brings us to a very basic thing. There's an obligation of mourning. It's not a voluntary thing. And I hear people say, oh yeah, we sat Shiva on Tuesday. I said, what do you mean? Shiva means 7. Because we sit 7 days of Shiva. You can't sit Shiva on one day. You can mourn for one day of the 7 days of Shiva. And so, there's a reason why we have 7 days. Who in their right mind thinks that in one day you can get over the loss of a loved one just like that? I don't even think Shiva is necessarily enough, but thank God there's some structure because else we'll never get out of it. But the idea that overnight, I can go back, my mom died on Tuesday and by Thursday I'm back to work? Oh, we're going to have the funeral in 2 months from now. So that has nothing to do with, I mean, whatever you choose to do with the funeral, that has nothing to do with the fact that we need time to cope. We need time to mourn, we need time to be, and we're going to talk about the details of how we are to cope, you know, what is the process of Shiva. It's not only about having a big a food fest, which a lot of Jews tend to think of Shiva as, you know, let's get a bunch of platters of food and after the funeral we come and eat. That's nice, but that's not what Shiva is. And how we're supposed to deal with someone. When you come into a Shiva house, Oh, what are we going to talk about? Let's talk, you know, let's make comedy, let's make joke. We'll talk about all these details of how we're supposed to behave. But let's look at text number 5 first, the obligation. Go ahead, Dan.
We are commanded to mourn the passing of next of kin.
There's an obligation to mourn. Some of the sages say that it's based on biblical verses, on the story of Abraham where he mourned his wife Sarah. Others say that it's rabbinic, but either way, it's a prime concept in Judaism. You know, they say the story about Mr. and Mrs. Greenberg. They went to see the producers on Broadway, and the show was sold out. They got some seats. They finally got in, and they see in the front row there's a lady sitting, but there's an empty seat next to her. So during the intermission, you know, you see such a prime seat, you start eyeing it. So Mr. Greenberg walks over to this woman and says, "Ma'am, I'm just curious. You know, this is a sold-out show. It cost a lot of money to get such a seat. Whose seat is that?" She says, "Oh, that was my late husband's. Unfortunately, you know, he's not here. So he says to the woman, he says, so you had no other relatives that could have come?" And he says, "No, they're all sitting shiva." And so, you know, in reality is, that's not a way you mourn. You don't sit at a show when you belong sitting shiva. And we have this tendency in America to totally overshadow this whole concept of mourning and not take the time to actually implement what needs to be implemented. And so, I believe you have figure 5.1 in your books. And so it gives you a little bit of an idea of the various stages of mourning. And so we start with aninut. Aninut is the moment, from the moment you find out of the passing until the interment. And so sometimes that's a day. In my mother's case, for example, I told you guys a few weeks ago that it was only about 4 or 5 hours. But at that point, you're absolved from all positive commandments, meaning you don't, if you didn't put on tefillin that day, you don't have to put on tefillin. It's your time to be in total state, the ultimate state of mourning, and you don't have to worry about anything else pretty much. Then you go into Shiva, which is the 7-day mourning period commencing. That starts after the burial. Then you go into Shloshim, the 30-day mourning period, which starts also at the burial. So the 7 of the 30 is Shiva, and then it continues to the 30th day. And it has various laws about haircuts and new clothing, etc. And then you have the 12-month period, which is the most lax of them all. But it's, you know, there's definitely rules that apply for all 12 months until the first yahrzeit of how you deal with coping with the loss. And then after that, only once a year on yahrzeit. And then you have, you know, the laws of one day a year. But it's the idea that there's a program. And this program is so important because it has emotional benefits. And the first thing you need to do in this program is to accept the reality. It's very important to ensure that the person that's mourning doesn't remain in denial. So what do you do to immediately get them out of denial into reality? Before the funeral even commences, from the moment the person dies until the moment that they're... Very good, Linda. The first thing you do is you rip the clothing. That makes a very, very real impression. You're now wearing a ripped garment, and if you see the way it's done properly, it's a ripped garment. It's not a little, it's not a bow, and it's not a little tear. It's a ripped garment. Let's look at the biblical idea where that comes from. Text number 6. I think we're up to you, Kathy. Go ahead.
The brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The brothers slaughtered a goat and took Joseph's tunic and dipped it in his blood. They sent the colored tunic and brought it to their father, and they said, "We have found this. We have found this. Identify whether it is your son's tunic or not." Jacob recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has been torn to pieces." Jacob rent his garments and put sackcloth on his loins, and he mourned his son for many days.
So when Jacob thought that Joseph was killed, by the whole story with Joseph and his brothers, and when they sold him and they came with a bloody vest that belonged to Joseph, and they said, "Look, there's blood," and they used the venison, you know, deer blood, because it looks very close to human blood. And Jacob for a while thought that his son was killed, murdered. What did he do? He ripped his clothing. Because we need to get into that state of acceptance of the reality and not stay in denial. You know, you can go into a state of numbness. You can become numb. And You know, like I said earlier, it's not about questioning what anyone you know did or what you did. That's not what it's about. But we all know that numbness, when it creates that paralysis, it's very hard to get out of it. Numbness could lead to a state of, at least on some level, a level of depression. Because what's numbness? You can't, you're numb, you can't feel, you can't move on. Depression is you can't get out of bed, you can't focus, you can't move on. And you, in order to move on, you need to accept the reality. And it's not a hell, I know a few people, not a lot of people, who they talk about their loved ones all the time as if they're still right here. On the checkbook, they'll still have it 30 years later, they'll have the name of the spouse. I get checks in the mail. So when you have on someone's checkbook a name of someone that died in 1988 and we're in 2015, there's an issue there. And so there's no question, there has to be a movement from that numbness, from the paralysis, into acceptance. And one of the key ways to do that is do something in the physical realm by ripping the clothing. We'll see the other benefits of ripping the clothing perhaps soon, but the first thing you do, in order to mourn, you need to be able to recognize that something happened here. And then you can mourn. And then once you mourn, you can move on from mourning. But the process can't start as long as you're in denial. And I bet that on some, you know, maybe not as much as rabbis experience, but my guess is that in your lives you've encountered, either within yourself or others around you, an experience where people did not know how to accept the reality, and because of that we're not able to move forward. It creates that paralysis that none of us want. But then there's the other side of it, and that is once you start mourning, you can't mourn for forever. I mean, you could. It's not a good thing to mourn for forever. That's it. We're going to mourn for the next 100 years. You can't do that. Look at text number 7. Go ahead, Linda, about the fact that we got to move on.
Neither cry for the dead nor bemoan him, Yirmiyahu. Neither cry for the dead more than necessary nor bemoan him more than what is prescribed. What does this mean? 3 days for weeping, 7 days for eulogies, and 30 days for the prohibition against wearing new clothing and getting haircuts. More than this, God says, you are not more compassionate than I am.
And so, I guess God is in a sense saying that if you don't stop mourning, and no one's more compassionate than God, and excessive mourning implies lack of faith in God's compassionate justice. You know, in other words, if you never let go, then really what you're saying is you don't ever accept what God has just done. So if you mourn a little bit for the time that the Torah prescribes, so you're human, and it's healthy, and it's emotionally healthy, and psychologically healthy, and spiritually healthy, but if you never let go, that means you're totally questioning God's behavior, and that's not either a good thing. But what the Torah is saying is that pathological mourning is not a good thing. It's not a good thing to be mourning for forever. And so if it's not a good thing to be mourning forever, then how do you move on? So that's why question for discussion on 179 comes up. What idea have we learned in previous lessons that might serve as a consolation to the mourner? So thinking back to the previous lessons, what is there in the process that could have guided us to have a better response, to be able to move on from the state of mourning and move into a state of, you know, moving forward? Go ahead, no, go ahead.
The concept that when you do good deeds, that
affects the soul. Yeah, there's no question. That's a big part of it. Number one is why are you getting stuck there forever if you know that there's a way that not only could you stay in touch with the soul, but you can actually create elevation and good things for the soul. And the idea in itself that the soul is eternal, that in itself could be a comfort to allow it to boost us to move forward. But there's something very interesting in Ashkenazic Jewish tradition. When you go to a house of Shiva, you go to a mourning, a home that's in mourning, the blessing that you tell the person that's sitting Shiva is, actually we'll read it inside instead of me saying it by heart. Go ahead, 8a, go ahead, I think we're up to you, Frank.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
May God console you among the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem.
Look at that text again. Read it, all of you. Why don't you look at it again and read it. May God console you among the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. Now put yourself in the mourner's shoes for a moment. Although mourners don't wear shoes. It's part of the mourning process. But put yourself in their
place.
Yeah, in their place. If someone walks up to you and says, "Hey, which is the Hebrew version of "May God console you amongst all the mourners in Zion and Jerusalem," it sounds fantastic. What does it actually mean to me? Zion, Jerusalem, I'm sitting here, I just lost my close relative, and you're talking to me about Zion and Jerusalem. What is the point of that? Anyone have a problem with that statement?
No.
No? You think it's nice to walk up to someone and say, "May God console you," instead of "May I console you"? Like, I'm standing right here. Why can't I console the person? Why am I bringing God into the picture? And Zion and Jerusalem, I mean, we're talking now about the destruction of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, and that's in some way supposed to comfort people that are mourning. Oh, by the way, we're mourning Jerusalem and Zion too, since, you know, the Romans in 70 CE destroyed the temple. Just so you should know, it's a collective thing. We're all mourning. As if, okay, and that's supposed to make me feel good?
Because if you're alive, you're going to feel mourning. You're going to feel sadness.
And so we tell them,
this is part of life.
We've been there, done that. You know, our people have been to places like this and we've come out of it. Very good point. So yes, you do talk about the collective people, the collective nation of Jews, because we've had our fair share and we're here on the other side. You know, it was actually, I was studying with Chaya this morning, in my morning studies with her, and we spoke about Jacob wrestling with the angel, which is today's portion of the Torah. And I sat there, I said, "What do you learn from this story?" And you know, I'm talking to a 6-year-old, so it's very different, but I said we learned two things from the story. Number one is that Jews do get bruised along the way. Jacob got really socked by that angel. But you know what happened at the end? Jacob was victorious. I said, we Jews, we get bombarded along the way. We have a lot of tzaras along the way. We have a lot of troubles. But at the end of the day, we always come out on the other side, so we'll be okay. And so in a sense, what Connie's pointing out is you come to someone that's sitting Shiva and you say, "Hey, I want you to know it's part of a collective experience and we've experienced this so many millions of times as a people and as individuals, and so we'll be okay," which is true. Go ahead.
It's hard for me to explain, but I feel there's somewhat this connection. People in loss feel disconnected. They feel the loss. Someone comes up to you and says, "May God console you." You feel God in them. You feel the connection with this great, with God. You don't feel like God's up there and they're here and there's separation. And then with the others, then you feel also connection to other Jews and to history and to it all.
And then
there's this movement of you praying for the other person. And so it's the movement of life.
I'll agree with you, and I'll tell you from a rabbi's perspective, that sometimes saying fluffy words do have an effect on people. And sometimes I wonder why. I just threw out some, even if it's true words, I'm not disagreeing with
words,
it's true.
Words.
But what I'm saying is you tell people, hey, you know, you basically what you're saying, Kathy, is you're giving them a dose of inspiration based on the bigger picture of our people and the history of our people. It's 100% accurate. But the question is the mourner, the one that's in that place, are they really grasping what you're telling them, and why would that positively uplift them?
They should feel it energetically.
Okay. No, I can't. Listen, again, every mourner is different. I can't argue. I'd like you to look at text 8b from a letter from the Rebbe. Now, this letter is written to Ariel Sharon. For those of you who may remember, in 1967, in the fall, Arik Sharon lost a son, a tragic loss. He was killed by a gun. He was playing with a gun which they thought didn't have any bullets in it. And their Negev ranch and in the south, and his son died. And he was very upset. And the Rebbe in New York really didn't know Arik Sharon at that point. But someone from Israel told the Rebbe that Arik Sharon was in a big, you know, emotionally was totally lost. And the Rebbe penned to him a very long letter. A letter that he claimed, Arik Sharon claimed, turned his, not his life around, but got him out of the rut that he was stuck in. This is an excerpt from that letter, one of the points that the Rebbe made to him about that situation. Go ahead, Connie, text 8b.
In regard to Zion and Jerusalem, the Romans, and before them the Babylonians, were given dominion only over the wood and stone, silver and gold of the temple's physical manifestation. But not over its inner spiritual essence, contained within the heart of each and every Jew. Over this, the nations have no dominion, and it stands eternal. So too, regarding the mourning of the individual. Death dominates only the physical body and the concerns of the deceased person. The soul, however, is eternal. It has merely ascended to the world of truth.
In other words, when you tell someone, hey, you know Zion and Jerusalem? What went down in Zion and Jerusalem? The physical structure was burned to the ground, but the Judaism died there? No. Look, Judaism's still alive, which means the mortar and brick went, it was destroyed, and it was very sad for our people. We still mourn every year on Tisha B'Av the destruction. But we don't mourn the destruction of Judaism. We mourn the destruction of a physical temple that stood in Jerusalem. And with your loved one as well, we're mourning the destruction, we're mourning the loss of the body. But not for a moment should you think that that means the loss of all of their being. It's not. Judaism survived post-destruction of the temple. Your soul, the soul of your departed loved one, will continue to survive even after the body is gone, which is the case right now. So it's something very deep. Now, I would recommend that if you're ever sharing that with someone, I do this all the time, is that if you're actually going to visit someone during Shiva, to actually share the idea with them. Because most people, when you just say a statement to them, oh, Zion is Jerusalem, they have no idea what you're talking about. But if you actually spend an extra 3 minutes and explain it to them, I think it would be very heartwarming to them, bring some temporary solace to them. But it goes even further. We spoke earlier about ripping the garment, rendering the garment. We tend to think of that as, like we said earlier, it takes you out of denial into acceptance of the reality. But it also gives you a very good education. Because when you rip a garment, again, what are you ripping?
The physical.
Something external. Take a look at text number 9. Go ahead, Jennifer. Very powerful.
Often, within their pain, mourners have an underlying belief that it isn't true, that their loved one hasn't really gone. This is not just denial. In a way, they are right. Death is not an absolute reality. Our souls existed before we were born, and they continue to exist after we die. The souls that have passed on are still with us. We can't see them, but we sense they are there. We can't hear them, but we know that they hear us. On the surface, we are apart. Beyond the surface, nothing can separate us. So we tear our garments. This has a dual symbolism. We are recognizing the loss that our hearts are torn. But ultimately, the body is also only a garment that the soul wears. Death is when we strip off one uniform and we take on another. The garment may be torn, but the essence of the person who remains is intact. From our worldly perspective, death is indeed a tragedy, and the sorrow experienced by the mourners is real. But as they tear their garments, we hope that within their pain they can sense a glimmer of a deeper truth. That souls never die.
So it is very heartwarming and educational to the person. The question is still remains, and that's to me, it's not easy, is what do you do with someone like Stephanie, who's stuck in their grief, and now you as a friend or a relative, or sometimes a spouse, you need to be there for them to try to get them out of this grief that they're stuck in, and you've tried everything we just said. And you can't really get to the bottom of why they're stuck there and why they can't even have a healthy conversation about it. Now, nothing that I'm going to share today, obviously, is a substitute for someone that needs a mental health professional. It's a silly thing in our society, and I don't know why it is, but that people still have this stigma. If they go to a therapist, then who knows how people are going to look at them. It's stupidity.
Huh? Everybody goes to therapists today.
Yes. Not everyone says it loud and clear. And some people use the rabbi as a therapist. But either way, the point is that there are mental health professionals, and there's nothing wrong with using them. But before you run to a mental health professional, you may not necessarily need one. You may just need to know what is our perspective as Jews for how to deal with it. And you may have the opportunity to lift someone out of that grief that they're stuck in without running and spending, I'll say on the low ball figure of $180 an hour. But that's definitely on the low side. But you don't... We don't need to run there. And so the question is, to understand why someone would be stuck in grief, we have to ask ourselves, what sort of painful feelings and emotions accompany the loss of a loved one? Why would a person be stuck in grief? And I want you to look at figure 5.2 and try to see if you can tell the difference. 5.2, figure on page 183, figure 5.2. A 90-year-old dies peacefully in his sleep. A 20-year-old dies from leukemia. How might reactions to these scenarios differ? I deal with people that lose 90-year-olds all the time.
Well, people think that the 90-year-old who died peacefully asleep had a great life, and he was given a blessing, and etc. And that 20-year-old who died from leukemia and not suffered, and because they don't see the larger picture and they don't really know what the program is, they feel that, you know, that it's a tremendous, that they feel that this is a tragedy and a great loss. And they haven't maybe had time, the 90-year-old, everyone's had time to enjoy him.
The 90-year-old has had a life. The 20-year-old dies before he or she's had a chance to fully mature and have that life that we imagine.
Oh, very good. I'm glad you made that point that we imagine.
That's the point, because we don't know the program.
Listen, most of us, when a 90-year-old is lost, it's still very sad for the one that's losing the 90-year-old. Let's not fool ourselves. A lot of people make that mistake and say, oh, your grandmother was 97? That's fantastic. What do you mean fantastic? The person in the middle of mourning, the loss of their Bubby or Zaidi, and you're busy telling them fantastic. You think it matters to them that it was 97? It doesn't. It's their loss. And they're sad, but they're not angry. They don't feel like there was an injustice here. Like you mentioned, they feel like the life was a fulfilling life. And so why would they be angry? When a 20-year-old dies from leukemia, not only are we sad, but we become angry. Angry because we feel like this was unjust, and we feel like this was a life taken from our midst before it had a chance to have any fulfillment, or at least, like you said, the fulfillment that we envisioned or that we imagined for the person. So, looking at 184, question for discussion, what ideas have we learned in previous lessons that might mitigate feelings of anger and injustice?
That God chooses when.
And that everyone has their own mission. Everyone has their unique mission. And try to lump one person's mission to the other is a futile endeavor of limited human beings who try to do that. Now again, I'm the first to admit, and truly the first, you know, that in reality when you're dealing with someone that's lost to leukemia at 20 years old or anything of that matter, or go into a cancer ward at Sloan Kettering of a children's cancer ward, It's beyond heartbreaking. You want to rip your hair out of your head. You feel like it's so wrong, but that's because we're not taking a pause just to think about. I don't want to use the word bigger picture, because when you're dealing with an individual, it's not a bigger picture, but with the life that's right in front of us. I know 18-year-olds that died that accomplished more in their life than most people do at 88. And I know 88-year-olds that all they do is watch TV and drink beer. Why they're still alive is not my business. That's up to God. But I wouldn't necessarily consider it a fulfilling life. But before I continue, does anyone have a comment or question before I go into this next long text? Go ahead, Kathy.
I just want to say that what I keep thinking throughout all this, you know, I had someone in my family passed on the last few years. And my family, my Jewish family in the East Coast, has never been so spiritually receptive as in this time. You know, when people are throughout their life, they understand that they have a relationship with God. They have a belief system. They don't all something happens and they still mourn. They still feel lost, but they have recourse. When I think the worst people, you know, and even children who are angry when a parent dies, for example, you still can, within the Judaism that you teach them, you can still give them comfort and explain things. But people who don't believe.
I always say that I feel bad for the atheist, because at least when I get upset, I can curse God out. If you're an atheist, who do you get to scream at? Nobody.
But they can't find reasons for things, you know? And so when things happen, they're really stuck.
I agree with you 100%. You know, at least there's a God. Even if you don't, you know, the Jew that screams, it's the God I don't believe in. But at least he's screaming at someone. You know, he has a relationship, maybe negative. But even a negative relationship is a relationship. But when you have nothing, when you claim not to believe in anything, you're stuck with nothing. Go ahead, Connie.
I had a question.
Yes.
It was, in the Jewish philosophy, does God say you have 88 years to do what you're supposed to do on earth? Or does he say your time is up when you've accomplished what you're supposed to do?
So there's no clear answer. In Psalms it says the life of a human being is 70 or 80 years. There's that, King David says that in Psalms. Biblically it says 120 years, but Psalms, which came much later, says that the average, if you wish, is 70 to 80 years. That being said, just because it's the average doesn't mean that there are souls that come down to this world to accomplish a particular thing. They accomplish what they need to accomplish and go. Sometimes we know what that is, sometimes we don't. But again, today's focus is not on the fact that a soul can leave this world early. The question is, how do we deal with the anger for that? How do we get over it? My mother's friend, who I referred to earlier, her son was 21 years old, shy, and he went to sleep. He went to sleep shmuley that night. And in the morning, it was getting late and late and late, and finally she had to break the door, his bedroom door, and he fell asleep. He went to sleep at night and never woke up. Her oldest child, who was 21 years old. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the anger and the feeling of injustice that comes with that? No one's saying the feeling is wrong. The question is, how do you get out of it?
How do you move through it?
Correct. How do you cope with that? How do you go through that journey and get out on the other side as a healthy, stable human being? Go ahead, Stana.
Well, I'm having this thought about how we each have souls that we're carrying with us in our living lives. We are challenged by the losses that we experience. And many of us will experience our most profound shifts within our own souls and perspectives through grief and mourning. And God has given us this opportunity to experience the loss of others for our own souls to benefit in learning and sharing and going forward.
No, there's no question. There's no question that one of the benefits, as crazy as it sounds, because it is crazy that someone had to die in the process for that to happen, but one of the things that happens is that even children, God forbid, who are going through, you know what that does? The resilience that parents go through dealing with a child that's, you know, with an illness that's, you know, that God forbid, they only have a few years to live. It does wonders, not only on a spiritual level, on a psychological and emotional level, but it's anger. And there's no question that part of that comes, in the beginning at least, there's anger. And how do you get over it? How do you get over that feeling? I felt injustice when my mother died. And I was lucky to know her for 29 years. And I was a son mourning a parent, not vice versa. The other way around, as someone mentioned earlier, I mean, losing a child and being able to deal with that. My grandparents in Israel lost, my aunt died while they were alive. And my grandmother she moved on with life. Never, not a moment passed in her life that she wasn't thinking about her daughter Yecheved. She couldn't. She buried her own daughter. There's something that about that, that the level of injustice that we feel for that, the anger, and how do we cope with that? And that's a question hopefully we're going to address in a moment.
But the therapist will say that is the first stage of mourning. And so somebody like, we don't really know Stephanie's story, but somebody who's so busy taking care of their children that they don't even have time, eventually they're going to hit that.
You're seeing anger and injustice, the feeling of injustice at the first stage of mourning?
It's the first.
Very good. But what happens if you can't get out of that first stage of mourning? Yeah, that's what we want to tackle today. How do you tackle like a person that's stuck?
That's a great question.
You know, I don't know if this is true for everyone. But if you really allow yourself to feel it and not hold back, eventually that energy will shift. That emotion transforms into something different. If you don't hold back, you know, if you don't suppress it and you just, you know,
let it out.
Punch your through the door, you go ahead and you do it. I mean, you just throw yourself into it, and then once you're in it, it's just a way of
getting through it. Okay, so let's look at text number 10. I don't even remember who we're up to, so maybe someone remind me. Go ahead, Stana. It's a long text, but it's a fascinating, fascinating tale, which I never read until this morning ever in my life. So go ahead.
Do these people think that death is unjust, or do they think that the cause of this particular person's death is unjust?
No. The fact that they lost this person at this age is unjust. They don't feel like this person merited to live a long enough life to fulfill whatever it is they envision them to fulfill, and they're angry about that. So it's not necessarily the particular illness, it's the fact that they're gone at such a perceived young age.
So it's an injustice against them. Their sense of loss.
Well, no, you could say even, you know, the fact that they feel like the other person is not, that they feel bad for the person that's not able to live up to, you know, to live that long life. So it could be also about altruistic in the sense, it could be about the person that's deceased, but in reality it's still just as tough. That person isn't able to have that experience and they're fuming about it. They're bothered by it and they're angry.
They think, why did you take that person from me? And,
right.
And why didn't you could make them better, why didn't you make them better?
Correct, and they get mad at God for that.
And you get very infantile kind of voice and they come up.
So that's my question, is that if you sense this strong injustice, you know, why wouldn't your drive be to eliminate the causes of these deaths? And I know that may seem like really big and far out, but I think that's what we're trying to accomplish through technology and medicine.
We got a long way to go with that, and again,
just that ancient sense of injustice and death, you know, we keep trying to defeat it. So I guess ultimately my question is, you know, what would you say is Judaism's philosophy on death? Should we accept it, or should we seek to eliminate it?
Should we, as in the medical world, seek to eliminate it?
All together.
We should definitely. We always have to seek to preserve life. I can tell you that from a Jewish perspective, we don't believe that doctors will ever be able to cancel death. That will be a messianic event that's part of the messianic prophecies. But they can help people not suffer as much in this world.
So people don't die in the time.
So they don't die. No, Mashiach comes, death is gone. That's the prophecy of Isaiah, Yeshaya. Let's look at text number 10. Go ahead, Stana. It's a long one, but truly from the most fascinating episodes I've ever read from Talmudic era. Go ahead.
When the son of Rabbi Yachman ben Zakkai passed away, his students entered to offer condolences. Rabbi Eliezer entered and sat down before him. Master, if it pleases you, I will say one thing, he said. Speak, Rabbi Yachman responded. Rabbi Eliezer said, Adam had a son who died and allowed himself to be consoled. How do we know that he was consoled? For it is stated Genesis 4:1, Adam was intimate again with his wife. You too should allow yourself to be consoled. Rabbi Yachman answered, not only am I pained because of my own loss, now you have caused me to be pained for Adam too. Rabbi Yehusha entered, if it pleases you, I will say one thing, he said. Speak, Rabbi Yachman responded. Rabbi Yehusha said, Job had sons and daughters, and they all died in a single day, if he allowed himself to be consoled. You too should allow yourself to be consoled. How do we know that he was consoled? For Job said, God has given and God has taken away. God's name be blessed. Rabbi Yachman answered, not only am I pained because of my own loss, now you have caused me to be pained for Job too. Rabbi Yosai entered and sat before him. Master, if it pleases you, I will say one thing, he said. Speak, Rabbi Yachman responded. Rabbi Yosai said, Aaron had two illustrious sons, and they both died in a single day, yet he allowed himself to be consoled. For it is stated, Aaron was silent, Leviticus 10:3. His silence implied that he was without grievance and accepted consolation. You too should allow yourself to be consoled. Rabbi Yachman answered, not only am I pained because of my own loss, now you have caused me to be pained for Aaron too. Rabbi Shimon entered. Master, if it pleases you, I will say one thing, he said. Speak, Rabbi Yachman responded. Rabbi Shimon said, King David had a son who died, and he allowed himself to be consoled. You too should allow yourself to be consoled. How do we know that King David was consoled? For it is David. 2 Samuel 12:24. David confronted Bathsheba, his wife, and he was intimate with her, and she bore a son. And he called his name Solomon. You too, master, should allow yourself to be consoled. Rabbi Yachman answered, not only am I pained because of my own loss, now you have caused me to be pained for King David too. Rabbi Eleazar ben Ach entered. When Rabbi Yachman saw him, he told his attendant, take my clothing and be prepared to follow me to the bathhouse, for Rabbi Eleazar is a great person and I will not be able to hold out in the face of his comforting words. Rabbi Eleazar entered. He sat down before him and said, I would like to share with you a parable. Your situation can be paired to that of a man whom the king entrusted an article for safekeeping. Every day the man would cry and shout, woe is to me. When will I be able to return the deposited item undamaged and be relieved of this incredible responsibility I bear? Master, you had a son. He read the Torah, prophets, and holy writings, and studied the Mishnah, the laws and the ethical teachings. He passed from this world without sin. You should be consoled because you returned your deposit in perfect condition. Rabbi Yachman responded, Rabbi Elazar, my son, you have confronted me.
Comforted
me in the most humane fashion.
What was wrong with what the four students told Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and why was he so comforted by the words of Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch? What did they do wrong, the first four guys? Job, Moses and Aaron, Adam and Eve. What was wrong with that?
Well, the fact that somebody else lost his son didn't make him feel any better.
Exactly. Just because someone else was consoled that way doesn't mean that me, Mr. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I'm going to be consoled the same way. I'm a different person. We each mourn differently and we're each consoled differently. Don't bring me examples. I don't care what biblical figure under the sun you want to throw at me. That doesn't help me. What did Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch do? He told him two most profound teachings that in our lives can also be used to schlep someone out of the people that are stuck in grief. That is, number one, you're not in charge of how long someone is supposed to live. We'd like to think that we know exactly what's supposed to be, but in reality we were given a deposit by God. We're supposed to keep it in its best condition as parents or grandparents or siblings, treat it to the best of our ability, and return it in the best way, you know, in the best way possible. But when it goes back, I gave you a deposit, God says. You're not in charge of telling me when I take that deposit back. And what that did for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was, hey, pause for a moment. Yes, I lost my son, but did I really lose something that belonged to me? I was given something. I enjoyed it. I loved having it. And the deposit was taken back. Of course I'm sad. Of course I'm mourning. But I can't get stuck there, because you can only get stuck there if you're convinced that you're in charge of this product when you're not. Which brings to the second point that Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch said, which is, you think the person lived an unfulfilling life? Why? Because it didn't have the quantitative years that you expected of it? That means it was unfulfilling? Some of you even here alluded to the fact that in our own vision or in our own imagination, 20 years is a joke. People still tell me I'm 33 old, I'm a pisser, I'm a joke, I'm a young... They don't say it negatively, they say it in a humorous way. So a 20-year-old is certainly a young kid that really didn't experience life. But what is it really about life that they didn't experience? Their life they experienced in full. They had the experience of life the way God envisioned it for them. And yes, they may have accomplished a lot, maybe for not as many years that you would have liked, doesn't mean they didn't accomplish things. And so when you talk, again, this is not an overnight, this is not a 15-minute, you know, it's not, you know, in New York there's 10-10 wins, the radio station. They go, you give us 22 minutes and we'll give you the world. This is not a 22-minute program that you're going to talk to someone and boom, I'll use the words of Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch and in 22 minutes I'll get them out of their grief. But it's a starting point. It's not mine to decide how long they stay with me. And it's not for me to decide what is fulfilling and what's not. Just because I wanted them to travel to Paris, or I wanted them to experience, get a PhD in some science that no one really cares about, and they didn't, doesn't mean it was a less fulfilling life. It just means that we need more time to cope with that Hashem had a different program for them. But to say that it's not fair and just, you can only say that if you don't recognize that life is not ours. I'm saying, if you think that life is yours, if you recognize that life is not ours, then why wouldn't it be? We're not so, are you angry? If you feel it's an injustice, what was the injustice? Your perspective was flawed in the first place to think that the just way is based on your understanding and not on God's understanding. But there's another big issue that people experience with loss. And I bet that all of us in this room can relate to it. And if you don't, I hope you never will have to, but the chances are you will, and it's called guilt. Sort of, you know, obviously in the beginning, Stephanie was an extreme case of guilt. Doesn't have to be that extreme, but the reality is that there's guilt. If only I had been better to them, why did I make the thoughtless and hurtful remark to them? Now that they're gone, we feel all bad. I should have visited and called more often. The typical, especially amongst Jews, there's a lot of guilt right away. And so the question is, on page 189, what ideas have we learned in previous lessons that can mitigate feelings of guilt?
Trust in God.
But in particular to the feelings that we have about guilt to the person that passed on, why would you feel guilty?
You would have ownership. You would be still trying to have the ownership.
Or, because, go ahead, Linda, what were you going to say?
Because we could have, or let's say, I could have behaved better. I could have had more patience, more compassion.
And now that they're dead?
It's over. But.
Oh.
But, Judaism believes that.
It's not over. And therefore, why do you feel guilty? Because you feel like you can't rectify what you screwed up during your lifetime? Of course you could rectify it. There's Kaddish, there's Yisker, there's all the things we spoke about that you could do for the soul. So why feel guilty? Because you can't fix it now? You absolutely can go ahead and fix it. Further, I mean, even more, the great Hasidic master of Aaron of Karlin, some 200 some years ago, said it very eloquently, text number 11, go ahead, go ahead, text number 11.
When children say Kaddish for their parents, it is like sending them regards. When they learn a chapter of Mishnah on their behalf, it is like sending them a letter. And when they fulfill mitzvahs and good deeds for the benefit of their souls, it is like sending them an entire parcel.
So think of it. Let's say children feel very upset when the parent dies because they feel like the last 2 years of their parents' life they were killing each other and it caused great heartache to the parent. And now the parent's gone and they feel guilty. You can't rectify that? Of course you can rectify it. Start getting along now. And being that you're still connected to the soul, they will experience what you're experiencing, and the soul will be in a place of bliss because you've rectified it. So the real guilt, I'm not saying there can't be any guilt, but the real guilt comes from thinking that now death is a death sentence, it's all over, and because it's all over, then we can't fix it. But now that we know from previous lessons that you could, so, it takes away a lot of that guilt. Which brings us to anyone have something to say? Both of you, okay, go ahead.
No, well, I have a question. I love about doing the mitzvahs and elevating the soul. Is it possible to bring pain to a soul by your actions?
Sure, we spoke about that, yeah.
And so, in a way, guilt could really be not doing what you could be doing, it could be not doing what needs to be done.
Most people that continue living lives that are inappropriate are not people that really internalize the idea that they're affecting the soul above, so there's not that much guilt associated with it. People that are more cognizant of the fact that the soul is eternal and they have a relationship with it tend to behave a little better than those that don't believe there's an afterlife and don't care really about what's going on there. So it's really intertwined with each other. If you recognize the fact that the soul is eternal, there's a much better chance you'll behave better because you know that the relationship still exists. So it's part of human nature. But people that don't believe there's an afterlife, which exists, are such people that don't believe the soul is eternal. They probably don't care very much about what goes on there anyhow. It doesn't exist. You're not bothered by it. Go ahead, Linda.
Okay, so I want to... It's a question, but also a statement about what if a person doesn't believe in God and doesn't believe in the eternal...
Eternity of the soul.
Of the soul. Then that person is creating his own hell on earth for himself, because if he hasn't behaved in a way that he feels comfortable with the deceased, then...
Correct. They have no solace.
He has no... Yes.
Someone that doesn't believe in the afterlife or that the eternity of the soul, and they feel guilty about someone they didn't treat properly or whatever, they are going to have a very tough life of guilt because they don't have... Again, it goes back to what I said earlier. People that don't believe have it much harder. I say this all the time. I really have pity on atheists. It must be a really tough life. At least we can blame God for some of the programs that go on here. When there's no one to relate it to, it's very hard. But going back to the hell on earth, I have to share with you the anecdote that happened with my mother about three weeks before she died. My aunt, my mother's only sister, she has two brothers and a sister, felt that it was imminent. The doctors knew it was imminent to get a Jewish psychologist, an Orthodox Jewish woman, to come talk to her about death. So this Jewish psychologist didn't know what she was signing up for, that she had to deal with my mother. So she came in and she says, she's talking to my mother, and my mother, whatever, she's playing ball. My mother knew that this was what was going to happen. And she tells my mother, Mrs. Brooke, I want you to know you're going straight to heaven. Now you could tell that to patients because it makes them feel good. My mother said, how do you know? And thank God, God planted the right words in the therapist's mouth, the psychologist's mouth. She said, Mrs. Brooks, you've been to hell already. And that was a smart psychologist. And my mother said, I like you. And for the next hour or whatever, she babbled to my mother agreed to listen because she had the right words to say at that moment. And so, but going back to what you said, there's an experience of hell. I'm just using American phrases, but there's an experience of turmoil that you can experience in this world because you don't believe that there's something more to it. And we have a tendency of thinking that people that are, people that have it tough are the people that, if you watch Bill Maher, which by the way is very entertaining, a little foul mouth, but very entertaining. He makes fun of all religious people, and I as a religious person find it sometimes very entertaining. But at the same time, I truly, at the end of the day, I know that people of faith can survive and endure because we know there's a program. And when there is no program, it's all nice to make jokes and it's good for humor, but in reality is that when individually, inside, internally, it becomes very, very dark and very, very confusing because you don't know what to do with the various experiences that we experience, including suffering and death. But now I want to talk about the practicalities of comforting the bereaved. We spoke about the philosophy. What about when you actually go to a shiva house? Look at text number 12. Go ahead, Dan.
The sages obligated us to visit the sick and console mourners. These are deeds of kindness that one carries out in person and have no rent. Although these are rabbinic ordinances, they fall under the purview of the biblical commandment to love your fellow as you love as yourself.
So, rabbinic, according to Maimonides, it's a rabbinic, general rabbinic obligation as part of visiting the sick. It's part of the greater mitzvah of loving your fellow as yourself, is to be there to comfort them in their time of mourning. The question is, what are you supposed to say? Text number 13, go ahead, it's a long one, Kathy.
Reward for visiting the home of mourning is boredom and silence.
Shut up. Don't say. Go there, give them a hug, sit there. And wait and see, maybe they'll ask you something. Just don't over-babble, because you're going to say something that's wrong and inappropriate and not even befitting for a mourning home. Look at text 14. Go ahead, Linda.
The comforters may not say anything until the mourner opens the conversation.
You're not allowed to start the conversation. You have to wait for them to start the conversation. You're visiting the mourner, let's see what they have to say. They're the ones that need your comfort. See where they're coming from. Don't sit down and just start babbling. Here's a few things you shouldn't do. Do not attempt to lighten the mood. Our job in a shiva home is not to create a comedy skit. And many times the mourners themselves will try to lighten it up by making jokes. And that's okay. They're the ones mourning and everyone mourns differently. I can tell you from first hand that in our shiva house it was very entertaining. But that was us creating the jokes and the comedy. But you should come in there and start cracking jokes because you think it's your job to lighten the mood. Why would you lighten the mood? Why would you take away the opportunity for them to actually experience the loss that they need? They need that coping time. Another thing we do is we philosophize. We sit there and we start giving theology lessons about how we're supposed to deal with passing. Here are some things you shouldn't say in a shiva house. Were you there when they died? Did she die from the cancer or the chemo? great thing to ask someone during Shiva. Did you know in advance or was it sudden? Do you know what you're going to create with those kind of questions? Do they have life insurance? You think it's a joke? Go to an Orthodox home during Shiva where there's hundreds of people coming through, the things that come out of people's mouths. God only takes the good ones. Tell that to someone while they're sitting Shiva. You don't start any sentence during Shiva that starts with the words at least, or you need, or don't. Just come and listen.
Write this in a pamphlet and give it to people.
It's something you don't. You can't. You, he's listening?
Yes.
He is.
He's listening.
Go ahead, Stana.
So let's say you've gone to Shiva and you've done the wrong thing. You said the wrong thing.
Listen,
apologize or let it go.
No, generally let it go. In Judaism, we don't get over crazy about, you know, silly things that we perhaps may have uttered, but we learn from our mistakes. You know, we do make mistakes. We say silly things, and you know, it's just part of life. But if to remember, when you're dealing with someone that's mourning, you don't want to be the one to add any sadness to their life. You know the story about the old guy, Mr. Goldberg, he died and his family was planning a big funeral. The local rabbi, they discovered, was out of town. The local rabbi was out of town, so they went across the street to the other synagogue and they asked him, could you run the funeral? So he says, sure. So he comes in, he does Kamal Erachan in the prayer, and he gets up there, he says, we're here to mourn the passing of our friend, Mr. Goldberg, a respected citizen and honored member of the community. Suddenly someone jumps up in the back of the room and says, what are you talking about, Rabbi? This man was a scoundrel, a thief. And he goes on and on and on. So the poor rabbi, you know, he was just taken over for another rabbi. He doesn't know. So he continues. He goes, we're here to mourn the passing of the patron of the synagogue. He's the patron of the synagogue. The guy's screaming, he never gave a nickel to the synagogue. So after three or four times, finally the rabbi turns to this guy in the back and says, maybe you can get up and say something nice about Mr. Goldberg? So he says, sure. He gets up there and he says, compared to his brother, he had a heart of gold. And so, you know, you need to have the right things to say. And most of the time we don't, because there really isn't anything to say, so shut up. Just come and be there for them. Don't say anything. Give them a hug. Show them that you care and move on. And when they need you, they'll find you because they know you care. Look at text number 15. Go ahead, I think, Frank.
The final word regarding a person is that of the people proclaiming his deeds, saying, so-and-so was upright. So-and-so was God-fearing. But when a person departs the world, God says to the ministering angels, see what people are saying about him. If they say that he had been upright and God-fearing, his soul immediately ascends to paradise.
So what do you talk about during Shiva? Talk about the person and their legacy. Don't try to figure out how they died. Talk about something that can actually bring comfort to the mourner, and that is, talk about the positive things that you have to share about that person that passed on, and how that legacy will continue, and how it affected your life. When people die in Chabad, and I happen to know them, what I always do if I'm sending an email or a note or I'm calling, I stay away from all the generics. I tell them what that person, and sometimes it could be a small thing, and I had a small interaction with them in my life that lasted 7 minutes. But it was so impactful to me, and I'm sharing it with them, that it makes all the difference. And so don't become a philosopher, and don't become a big expert in psychology. And don't try to interrogate and figure out exactly what took place. It's none of your business. What are you sticking your nose there? What does it matter to you if they have life insurance or not? This is the typical Jewish yenta trying to find that information. It's not relevant to you. No, I'm serious. Like the ultimate definition of a yenta. What are you sticking your fachazata business into their business and what's going on in their life? Focus on the things that you could focus on.
It's meaningful what you said about even if it's about mentioning something positive. My mother passed on overnight when I was 13. And I felt that I perceived the angels. And so when all these people came and they all said, we're so sorry, we're so sorry. I said, it's okay, she's with the angels. But I felt like I had to comfort everybody. I felt very uncomfortable.
That's not what's supposed to happen. When people came to me and they said, sorry, I said, what are you sorry about? It wasn't your fault.
You know, but
and that put them on the, like, oh, they thought they're going to be nice and say sorry, but they said it to the wrong guy.
Maybe sensitive later on, and I kind of comforted everybody. I think that's why I ended up taking the path I ended up taking. But it made me sensitive later in life in these situations of being with young people and not going and saying, I'm sorry.
Right, listen, when my mother died, the thing that affected me most was the hundreds of emails we received. My mother was a teacher of first grade for many, many years. And it was these kids who were now out of first grade. Some of them were teenagers, some of them were even married. And they wrote these short experiences that when I was in your mother's first grade class, you know, and I knew that about my mother, I didn't need them to tell that to me, but hearing it from them really affected me, is that she did go the extra mile to make sure every kid, particularly kids that had an issue at home. If there was a child from a divorced family, my mother had a soft spot for them and she would make sure they were taken care of because she knew that at home it wasn't hunky-dory. And so she went the extra mile. And so, but when I heard it from other people, that was more meaningful than all these philosophies. I didn't need anyone's philosophy. I'm the rabbi. I'm supposed to be the one with the philosophy. And no philosophy helps you in those moments. It's not philosophy that gets you through these moments in life. It's hearing how the person affected such positivity and how that legacy will have an effect for generations to come. And so going to learning exercise on 192, and with that, before we do the key points, write down the point from today's lesson that resonated with you most on a personal level. There's pens on the table in front of Stana. And if you are currently grieving the loss of a loved one, identify an idea you can focus on that will help you heal and live a fuller life. We'll now continue with the key points. I don't need anyone to share it. It's for you. Just a little moment to analyze what we studied. Connie, we're with you at the first three of the key points on 193.
Everyone reacts to and deals with grief differently. No two people are psychologically alike, and no two circumstances of death and bereavement are the same. It is a mitzvah to mourn the loss of a loved one. Acceptance is an important first step of mourning. This is exemplified by tearing one's garment, which is a tangible expression of loss. Processing a loss is critical to the healing process. This is accomplished by Shiva, a mandatory period of grieving.
Jennifer, if you read the next three.
The Torah validates and encourages mourning, but only for a prescribed period of time, after which the mourner is enjoined to transition back to normal life. When one knows that the soul lives on and is not diminished by death, death loses its all-annihilating force, and one can slowly find the strength to move on. Mourners commonly feel anger and a sense of injustice, especially when the deceased's life was cut too short. We can cope with these feelings in knowing that A, life is a deposit and God decides when to give it and when it must be returned, and B, for this soul and its unique mission, this constituted a full life. 6, mourners commonly feel guilt due to what they perceive as a lost opportunity to right wrongs they have committed against the deceased. However, it is never too late to improve our relationship with the deceased. Though our physical relationship is over, we can still give him or her spiritual gifts.
And the last two, Stana, wrap it up for us.
The most basic principle of comforting a mourner is simply being there. Our presence offers comfort and lessens the loneliness that often accompanies mourning. Proper Shiva etiquette includes not offering comfort until the mourner opens up the conversation, not attempting to lighten the mood, not philosophizing or teaching, not saying or asking anything that is intrusive, and discussing positive qualities and achievements of the departed.
Which leads us to the final lesson, which will be next week, lesson 6, the ultimate destination, the Kabbalah of life, death, and resurrection. What does Judaism say about resurrection? Stay tuned for that class.